Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Tim Dinkinson, who is the National Affairs Correspondent at Rolling Stone magazine, who blogs at rollingstone.com. He covered the Obama campaign for Rolling Stone, and one of his articles, The Machinery of Hope, was anthologized as the best American political writing of 2008. He has an article in the current issue of Rolling Stone, Inside the Republican Suicide Machine. Welcome to Background Briefing, Tim Dinkinson.
Glad to be with you.
And clearly things are coming down to the crunch on Monday night. The meeting has been postponed of the congressional leaders at the White House, and now it seems to be in the lap of Harry Reid and Mitch McConnell. So assuming, and there's all kinds of kumbaya going on there between those two, which is unusual, but assuming that they make a deal, what happens at the House?
It's confusing. It sort of remains to be seen whether John Boehner has sort of, by giving the Tea Party faction of his conference the shutdown they were looking for, whether he gained himself enough political capital that he can bring a vote to this to the floor, and I think it will surely pass. But whether that is going to make certain members of his conference so angry that they're eager to seek new leadership is kind of an open question at this point. But it seems fairly clear that Boehner's determined to avoid a default if he can, but question is just whether he'll do that if it means that he's giving up his power.
Well, I guess the Senate is basically, he'll be having to follow the Senate, and I take it it will probably mean that the Senate's basically saying, look, take it or leave it, aren't they? I mean, they don't want any more negotiation. There's not any time, is there?
No, there's not. And this fits a pattern where Boehner has sort of led from behind from the Senate. So the Senate approved the fiscal cliff deal by an overwhelming margin. The Senate approved the violence against women reauthorization and one or two other big votes that Boehner has sort of seen fit to use that as cover to bring a vote to the floor, even if it means that his conference, the majority of his conference, won't vote for it. And he has to rely on Nancy Pelosi and Democratic votes to get the business done. So it's a question of how many revolts he can really suffer in his own conference before it becomes perilous to his own continued viability as Speaker, whether there's real anger about whatever comes out of the Senate, in which case Boehner's sort of going to have to weigh his options, whether he lets the country go into default or whether he risks being toppled from his position.
Well, of course, it's worth reminding our audiences, Tim Dinkinson, that the government's already shut down. that's the second threat we're talking about, the default. I mean, it's almost like we've forgotten, as many have said, that in order for John Boehner to keep his job, hundreds of thousands of Americans have to lose their jobs. And that's the reality if you're a government employee at the moment. Now,
there's some irony to this, too. No, I would just say that there's some irony to this, too, because a couple of weeks ago it looked like Mitch McConnell was in a very, very perilous position and had sort of disappeared from these negotiations. It didn't look like he could step up and do anything at all for fear that he was going to he's got a Tea Party challenger in Kentucky coming up in the next election. And he seemed very cautious. And oddly, this move to shut down the government, being as unpopular as it is, seems to give McConnell new life and new political rope to maneuver with and actually be forging a deal with Harry Reid in sort of a very familiar way. And so there's an odd way in which the shutdown, I think, did Mitch McConnell a big favor by just giving him more room to operate. And it may, in fact, be the thing that saves us from going the way of Detroit.
Well, Tim Dinkinson, your article Inside the Republican Suicide Machine in the current issue of Rolling Stone, I learned a lot about the inner workings of the Republican Party, and particularly in the context of this shutdown, of who the real protagonists are. And I wasn't aware of the important role of the Republican Study Committee, which has 174 members of the 232 House Republicans. Its former chair, Jim Jordan of Ohio, seems to be the sort of shadow speaker in these internal battles going on. According to your article, he sits on a shadow leadership team which has been dubbed the Jedi Council. So let's assume that there's some adult supervision here and that Reid and McConnell come through with this deal and it goes back to Boehner, and Boehner really has no choice but to open it up to the full House. and meaning the Democrats and the moderate Republicans will get it over the top. And then you'll have this bitter backlash from the Jedi Council, Jim Jordan, and the Tea Party people. What then happens to Boehner and his leadership?
Right. Well, it's this is the open question. I mean, the thing to understand is that Jim Jordan commands what I talk about as a faction of 50, 50 members, more or less. It's a shifting coalition depending on the issue that has worked very openly in defiance of Boehner and his prerogatives, always trying to move Boehner to the right. And this is particularly evident in party line votes where they're trying to do something big and strategic. You know, it's interesting that, you know, the House Republicans haven't introduced their own plan to avoid a default, and it's basically because they can't get enough unity in their own conference to even put an offer on the table. And part of the reason for that is this sort of faction of 50 that won't go along and will divide, you know, deprive a Republican speaker, Boehner, of the majority that he needs to pass legislation on a party line basis. And so the question is, how limited is that faction? Is that faction 50? Is it 70? Is it, you know, how many people are really, really going to be angry about this move? And it only takes 50 folks to vote for a special conference that would bring a new leadership election. And so if you've got a faction, if this, you know, core faction of 50 swells in size on this issue to, you know, 100 or so, you could have a real honest-to-goodness revolt, and we could see a change in leadership. And it may not just stop at Boehner. There's a possibility that it could be, you know, the entire leadership team that gets riled in this outrage. But I don't know. It's hard to say at this point whether, you know, this sort of hardcore faction of the GOP is at all chastened by what's going on in the poll numbers and sort of burnt out from the experience of having done something as dramatic as shutting down the government, whether they're really united or able to unite a larger coalition against, you know, in favor of defaulting on the debt.
Again, I'm speaking with... sorry. I know, it's hard to keep up with the disasters. Needless to say, there are two concurrent ones going, shutting down the government and threatening to tank the economy via a default. Again, I'm speaking with Tim Dickinson, who is a national affairs correspondent at Rolling Stone magazine. He blogs at rollingstone.com, and he covered the Obama campaign for Rolling Stone. And one of his articles, The Machinery of Hope, was anthologized as the best American political writing of 2008. He has an article in the current issue of Rolling Stone, Inside the Republican Suicide Machine. But if it only takes those 50 votes to open up a committee to look for to open up a vote for a new speaker, normally they vote the speakers in when the new Congress is seated. But if you can get a special vote going, wouldn't the Democrats, they get to vote too, don't they?
They do, and so there's always a danger that you need to have the backup candidate well positioned. You know, you can't sort of go into this thing blind. There has to be some strategy behind it. Although House Republicans haven't been behaving in a particularly strategic fashion lately. So it's a question of whether this is just an emotional move. I mean, we're getting several steps ahead of ourselves, even assuming that this sort of thing happens. But the speaker is elected by a majority of the House altogether. And so there's an outside chance that Nancy Pelosi briefly could emerge with the speakership again if Republicans are divided and Democrats stay united around her. But these are sort of outlying possibilities. But I think it's just really going to be an interesting question to see whether this exercise in shutting down the government has gotten enough of the yah-yahs out of the, you know, the Ted Yohos and Louis Gohmerts. Have they exercised whatever destructive impulse they needed to exercise by shutting down the government, and then they're not going to go along with something that increases the debt ceiling and reopens the regular functioning of government, or they sort of retrenched in a place that they're feeling they need to take an even harder line. And
well, I guess what I was getting at,
the moderate Boehner.
Sure, but what I was interested in, you know, I want to get off this subject, but just before we do, I wanted to find out whether or not Jim Jordan, the head of the Jedi Council, the shadow leader, the guy that's behind this push that's this Tea Party putsch that's making Boehner is so uncomfortable, apparently, whether or not he has ambitions to be the Speaker. I mean, that most politicians are pretty ambitious, or is he? Does he enjoy being the kind of, you know, the guerrilla leader behind the scenes?
Well, it's interesting, because I don't know that Jordan has, you know, majority support within his conference. He's got a large number of supporters and a core group that's numbering in the dozens. And so it's a question of, if he were to stand forward, does he gather enough of the Boehner block? Of Boehner has his own block of about 50 members too, and so are those folks who would rally behind Jordan, or would they gravitate towards somebody more like? I mean, the only person I could see sort of standing as a plausible Speaker candidate is Paul Ryan. Frankly, he's the sort of one who has enough currency among the RSC members and sort of more establishment Republicans. You know, he's the one guy who I can see sort of bridging that gap if it's not, you know, Cantor or Boehner.
I see. Well, let's turn to the other aspect of one of the things, other things in your article in Rolling Stone, Tim Dickinson, Inside the Republican Suicide Machine. And I've done some coverage on this earlier about the Williamsburg Accords, which took place shortly after the stinging defeat in 2012. The Republicans went to this retreat in Williamsburg to lick their wounds. And at that meeting, they came up with the Williamsburg Accord, which essentially is the culmination of that strategy that they worked out, isn't it? Where they would simply not negotiate with the White House or the Senate and force Obama to come to them.
Right. But it's interesting because the Williamsburg Accord didn't have anything about a government shutdown in it. And in fact, had sort of. So the idea was that they got together at this retreat in Williamsburg, Virginia, and the Jedi Council was sort of brought in by Boehner to sort of say, okay, well, conservatives, what do you want to do? I'm tired of fighting with you. I'm tired of having coup attempts against me. I want to unite my conference, unite my team. Conservatives, let's set the agenda together, and I'm going to move to the right instead of trying to get you to follow me out towards the center. And so they devised this whole plan to force a debt ceiling fight, and they thought it was going to happen in the spring, but the government ended up with a lot more money, both from tax revenue and from Fannie Mae, than was expected. And so they had this very carefully plotted strategy, and it was all going to be centered around getting the budget on a 10-year path to balance, which is what Paul Ryan's budget now calls for. And so it was. You know, at least a pretty sophisticated negotiating strategy, but it was actually had some flexibility towards it so that you could count something like change CPI, which is the change in Social Security benefits for future retirees that President Obama has in his own budget. And you could count that on this 10-year time horizon and, you know, keep the debt ceiling, raise it for a few months with that. You know, so you could, there were sort of ways that the president could be coaxed into kicking the can down the road a little bit and avoiding a default by, you know, embracing things that he had put in his own budget. And so it actually was a fairly sophisticated negotiating strategy. And what happened is this government shutdown stuff got in the way and sort of scrambled that strategy completely, such that the first opening in the debt ceiling negotiations was something about the Keystone Pipeline and tax incentives for oil drillers, and it just had nothing to do with this sort of carefully plotted strategy that they'd formulated, and that's largely due to these outside groups and Ted Cruz, who came in and advised this shutdown fight over Obamacare, which has been roundly self-defeating.
So, what does this mean? That Ted Cruz has sufficient charisma that he can get these guys riled up and strapping on the suicide vests and marching off the cliff?
Well, it's not just Ted Cruz. It's a whole machinery behind Ted Cruz that encompasses the Heritage Foundation, it's the Club for Growth, it's Heritage Action, it's the Senate Conservatives Fund. It's a series of outside groups that play. They score different votes, and they will primary Republicans who are deemed insufficiently conservative, sort of, you know, brand them as Republicans in name only and go after them with well-funded primary opponents. And so it exercises this whip function that people don't want to get on the wrong side of these groups and their scorecards. And they made this the campaign of the summer. They sort of hijacked August and made this charge on the hill of Obamacare, you know, that was had about as much chance of success as Custer's last run, but sort of made that the cause celeb of the moment in Republican circles and activist circles. And at the end of August recess, you had this group coming back of 80 or so members who were insisting on this as a precondition for moving forward, and so we ended up with a shutdown government. So, it is partly Ted Cruz's charisma, but there's a whole machinery behind Ted Cruz that you need to understand why this actually happened.
So, obviously, I'm finding it difficult to understand how they could do what they're doing and have these such negative results so quickly. Polls saying that the Democrats are going to pick up the House now as a result and that the Republicans won't be able to take back the Senate. All the polls are coming out today, and you just mentioned a change of fortune for Mitch McConnell against his Tea Party challenge. So it's like reality is coming in like a monster wave, you know? And I'm just surprised that these guys, do they live in a bubble or something? Didn't they understand that this would be the likely response, or are they so consumed by their zeal and righteousness that they just were blind to the consequences?
I think it's a combination of things, but you have to understand there's about 100 members of the House conference for whom reality, outside reality, doesn't really matter very much, because their biggest threat is not that they're going to be challenged by some moderate Democrat in a general election. Their seats are in these so-called landslide districts that are basically impossible for a Republican to lose. And so they need to guard against the anger of an activist base who's going to say, you know, why didn't you stand with Ted Cruz? Why weren't you righteous and fighting these evil Democrats and the socialism of Obamacare? And so their reality is very insular and different from the actual political realities in America. And so their political calculus is quite different. And in fact, you know, most of these folks got elected by promising to take a stand and repeal Obamacare. And so that this is not, you know, these folks are in fact are representing their constituents in a surprising way. It's just that their districts are drawn so strangely that the people who are not turning against Republicans right now are the people who are stocked in those districts. So there's actually not that much political risk for individual members. There's real consequences for the larger Republican team, but for many of these members, there's going to be no political fallout for having fought this fight. In fact, there probably would have been grave fallout if they hadn't.
Well, we just have to close now, Tim Dickinson, but you talk about this young 50-year-old Tea Party leader with the Freedom Works organization, Matt Kibbe. I think Freedom Works, I think, is funded by the Kochs. But in any case, you ask him about the House today, and he says with a wry smile, beautiful chaos. So now that the Kochs have sent their letter to the Senate saying that, you know, we're not behind the default, maybe we should ask for another comment from Matt Kibbe, right?
I'm not sure that Freedom Works is – I think they may be splintered from the Kochs. But there's an element to which – but again, all of this stuff is just – it's very complicated. But there's an element to which this is – it's just interesting that we call these folks conservatives when, in fact, they're behaving in the most radical fashion possible. And as folks like Kibbe sort of point out, it's actually sort of an anarchist impulse. Like they just want to blow things up and see where the chips lie rather than being strategic.
I see. Well, okay. Well, I think I may be wrong on who funds Freedom Works, but it's obviously, if it's not the Kochs, it's another like-minded billionaire. And I thank you for joining us, Tim Dickinson.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Again, I'm speaking with Tim Dickinson, who's the National Affairs Correspondent at Rolling Stone magazine, and he blogs at rollingstone.com. He covered the Obama campaign for Rolling Stone, and one of his articles, The Machinery of Hope, was anthologized in the Best American Political Writing of 2008. He has an article in the current issue of Rolling Stone, Inside the Republican Suicide Machine. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking with the author of Polarized America, The Dance of Ideology and Unequal Riches.